Unibet. Episode 82. Troy Ward, Analytics-Guru und Ex-NHL-Assistant sowie Ex-Linz-Head-Coach.
I think for hockey fans and enthusiasts, like if you said, do we finally have a really even Stanley Cup where it could go either way and possibly a seven-game series, this is it. I mean, this is the two horses going at it. Like these are the big boys right now. And so it's a toss-up, you know, right now for me a little bit. Obviously, I have to make a pick on who I think would win, and I'll say that. But I would say this is close to a toss-up as we've had. And it's a toss-up even analytically.
Die Tribüne erhebt sich. Und der Hexenkessel kocht. Da bleibt kein Moment, um einmal durchzuatmen. Bring it on. Mit dem Torhänder abgefälscht und die Scheibe im Tor. Aus dem Nichts. Wie schön war das gemacht.
Unibet Hockey O'Clock. It is the day before the start of the Stanley Cup Finals. Obviously, game one between the Colorado Avalanche and the Tampa Bay Lightning happening Thursday, 2 a.m. Central European summertime. Everybody's been looking forward to this matchup for a very long time, and that's the reason why on Unibet Hockey O'Clock we have to have a true National Hockey League expert, and not only an expert as regards the National Hockey League, but also as regards analytics. It's no one else than former Black Wings head coach Troy Ward, who's now on the Unibet Hockey O'Clock line and coach. So thankful for you taking the time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you. It's good to see you again.
Same here. It's been quite some time that we last talked. It's been quite some time that your feet last touched Austrian soil. We're talking about the early stages of January in 2019, but knowing you, or I knew that you're always busy. One of the brighter hockey minds I've met. So for all the people who haven't really followed what you've been up to ever since, what have you been up to?
Well, Martin, I, you know, came home, as you mentioned, there in January. My wife and I flew back from Linz there to the U.S. here and got back here and kind of settled back into life. And obviously, it's January, so you kind of settle into your life and try and figure out your next steps and plot along. And most importantly, as we all mature in life, we understand that some decisions as we get older now are based on two people. A lot of times early in our lives, we base our decisions on one party and their employment, which was the case in most coaches. But when we got back home here, it was more of a team decision. My wife and I decided that we wanted to live in our summer residence full time the rest of our life. So we kind of hunkered down here in Wisconsin, so to speak. We live here full time. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to try and find some work where I can live and work out of my home full time. So went from coaching for 35 years and went into scouting, where it allowed me to live at home and travel out of here. So I was fortunate enough to get back home here, like I said, in January. And then by July, I had a job with the Vancouver Canucks to become a U.S. amateur scout. And that allowed me to live at home and be with my wife, Marilyn, where she was going to work full time. And so that's what we've been doing since we left Linz, is got hired by the Vancouver Canucks, and this just completed my third year as a scout.
Now, the Terminus Scout, it's always a loaded one because there's so many different job descriptions within the Terminus Scout. You said you're an amateur scout for the Vancouver Canucks. How does an average day of work look like in your hockey life?
Well, it's significantly different than, you know, being in Linz, you know, as a coach. You know, you're up at, you know, 4 or 5, whatever time in the morning. You get in, you get your coffee, you kind of get planning for the day because the guys get in early, and it's an all-inclusive day as a coach. You go basically from early morning to late afternoon to early evening every day for about 7-8 months. As a scout, it's completely different, to be honest with you, Martin. It's more of a night job where I'm traveling by way of car or by plane during the day and then watching a game at night. So similar to being a coach, but I'm not behind the bench. And then you have to travel after the game to your next place. games kind of come in lumps. So for our listeners, you know, as a U.S. amateur scout, how many games would I see on average per year over the last 3 years? About 220. So that's a lot of hockey. I mean, that's, you know, obviously in Linz, I didn't coach 220 games in 1 year. So it's obviously a ton of hockey. You're on the road a lot. But the good news is, you know, during the course of a day, my day, I might get to the office here where I live at 7 a.m. instead of 5:30. And I work from 7 a.m. until noon on my reports and my rankings of players. And then from noon until whenever I have to leave again, depending on a flight or how much, if I'm driving, I've got the time to just kind of be by myself and do my own thing. So there's a lot more downtime. As a scout, we call it a lot of windshield time. You're behind the wheel a lot, especially where I live and watching U.S. juniors and USHL. So you're behind the wheel a lot. You get a lot of time of thinking and driving and trying to plot your way through the world a little bit. So it's significantly different than coaching for sure.
There are a ton of reasons why I brought you on the program. Obviously, you know, in the National Hockey League inside out, you, of course, haven't followed great playoffs, great Stanley Cup playoffs so far, but you also being an expert as regards analytics and the way you prepared your team when you coached. I was lucky enough in December of 2018 to get a sneak peek of what you're literally throwing at your players, like the preparation unlike any I've ever seen. And a lot of it includes analytics as well. You told me a little bit about your personal history and how everything started. A whole lot of topics I want to eventually tackle. But if someone's never heard of analytics, and I doubt there are a lot of listeners on this program who've never heard about it, but if there's a new listener who goes like, analytics, hockey, what is that? How would you explain that to a person having never heard of analytics?
Well, I think analytics helps you if we could look at it in terms of like a tree, you know, a tree out in the wilderness. It gets to the root of the situation. Like analytics gets down to the root of what's happening in the game. So let's just say, let's take power play and penalty kill. All right. Special teams. When I was in Linz, we made a decision because it was the pick, you know, you play through the pick round and then you have to decide who you want to play in the playoffs. My first year, we decided to play Croatia. And we picked that team based on our special teams regular season. We were off the charts on the power play. We were really good on the penalty kill. I thought that was our best matchup to move forward. We ended up going down 2-0 and ended up kind of coming back and winning 4 straight, but based on power play and penalty kill. So, you know, when you look at analytics as it relates to the game of hockey, if everybody's familiar with the power play and the penalty kill, well, if you put out the 5 guys in this year's Stanley Cup, what is the percentage of like those 5 guys personally that have on the impact, and what are their individual numbers on success rate versus their time on the ice? So let's just say, you know, the same 5 guys go out the whole Stanley Cup. What is their percentage as individuals, not so much as a team? And the same with the penalty kill. So, you know, had great penalty killers and Phil Lucas and Jake Dowell and guys around me that were when I coached in Linz. Some of those guys, like let's just say Phil Lucas, no matter who I put Phil Lucas with, I could have put him with an Austrian, I could have put him with a North American. He always did well on the penalty kill because he understood the game at such a high level relative to that situation. So he would become analytically my best penalty killer regardless of who I put him with. And so that made us a better team if I knew that side of how many times he went on the ice and his success rate individually for him versus what my team penalty kill record was. So that helps you just get down to the root of the tree and to the root of the situation. And I believe that that's a powerful tool in the game of hockey.
That's interesting. If one looks at your career trajectory and everything that you did and all the places that you coached, that you, of course, are having a history with the University of Denver. Of course, last week, David Carl, reigning NCAA championship winning head coach of the University of Denver, jumped onto the program. You coached, or you quote unquote grew up in the NCAA system, coached USHL, moved on to the National Hockey League, had experiences with the East Coast Hockey League, the American Hockey League. So many, many different leagues. But the one thing that ties it all together is that the analytics kind of remain the same. At what point did you understand that this is something that deserves a further or a second look that you want to really wrap your head around?
Probably 1991, when I was at the University of Denver. One of your former guests this year, we crossed paths, is you had him on your podcast. His name is Kevin Constantine. He coached the Hungary team this year in the Ice League. Lost out to Salzburg in the finals. Kevin and I met in 1991. We spent a significant amount of time in the summers at a hockey school together. And, you know, at that time, there were barely computer uses, printers. Everything was more the old school printers, and it took forever to print something. And, you know, and just the computer use was at a real beginning stage. But Kevin is a very mathematically driven person. He used to teach math in high school and before he ever became a coach. And so he's a bright man mathematically, and he kind of introduced me to me. And soon after, by the time 1992 to 93, I was deep in analytics, in tracking numbers. And at that point in time, most people weren't even watching video, let alone tracking math or tracking the game in a mathematical way. So, that's kind of when I got into it. And then from there, it just grew. And then Kevin and I crossed paths when he became the head coach with the Pittsburgh Penguins in 97. I became his assistant. And in 1997, speaking of the Stanley Cup, we played in the Stanley Cup our first year there, not in the cup itself, but in the playoffs. And analytics was a huge part of how we played. That year, we went lost out to Montreal. The next year, we were the eighth seed. We played the New Jersey Devils, which was the first seed, in our second year in Pittsburgh. And as you know, following the Stanley Cup for years, not many eighth seeds beat the first seed, but we beat them. And analytics was a huge part of how we won that series. But no one in the NHL was doing analytics at the time. So Kevin was ahead of his time, and we got ahead of most people just by tracking numbers.
And if I'm not mistaken, Kevin Constantine still holds an NHL record because he's the only head coach who took 2 8 seeds to a first round upset against the number one seed. One of them obviously being Pittsburgh, where you worked with him. But take listeners back to the late 90s. And you said analytics weren't happening in too many other places, if any. How did the cupboard look like? Bare?
Yeah, it was bare. Yeah, it was pretty bare. And it was really, I mean, I think anybody that once you get around it, it's like school. Once you're ingrained into a higher level of math, you kind of grow real quickly and your brain kind of reaches new levels. I thought our players did in Pittsburgh over a period of time, the initial year of putting out a printout of like 15 pages of stats, numbers and math, the guys were like, whoa, like, you know, like this isn't really being, we can't follow this. This is just a game. And we had the likes of Ronnie Francis, Jaromir Jagr, Alexei Kovalev. Like, we had good players, and players not too far from you now where you're living. So it's like Jaromir and Jagr and guys like that, analytics wasn't as much of a powerful tool to them, but it became more powerful as they analyzed the game in a different way. I thought Kevin took those players to a different level of looking at the game mathematically. Obviously, Jaromir, every year set out to be the number one scorer in the league. And obviously, during our time in Pitt, he was. But there were a lot of things that I thought that developed later in life through a lot of those players where they understood the game a little bit differently as it relates to the math and who plays with them, what they're producing on their wing. You know, is my center the key to being a right wing for Jaromir Jagr? Is it actually the left wing and the left D? Who gets you the puck more? Do you get it from the middle or do you get it from the far left side over to the right side? And so when you look at those analytical things and you track entries and how you're entering the zone all the time with what type of time and space, are you inside the dots, outside the dots, all those analytical points that we used to pick out, I thought a lot of players grew through Kevin and the staff in Pittsburgh on that.
This growing process, as you introduce something, I'd go as far as saying radically new. Usually in all parts of life, those developments are met with not exclusively enthusiasm, but also some skepticism. Was there ever a point where you thought, okay, there's skepticism, but it's decreasing, and this person or this unit slowly but steadily really finds out what analytics are all about and how they might be able to help them?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's met with, still to this day, more resistance than it is with positivity. I think, you know, if you're a person that is inclined to be in athletics, whether you're a coach, a general manager, or a player, and you grow up with a kind of a feel for numbers and you like that part of life because numbers drive the world basically in any business, then I don't think it's such a big thing. But there are still many teams in the NHL today where analytics plays a very, very little part of what they do and what type of decisions. We are, or I am now as a scout, also in the analytics side, you know, because we look at numbers of players and we make projections. And so, but I'm used to it. I believe there's a value to it. It's just a matter of when. So to your point of the question is when did the players give some pushback or were they accepting of it? I would tell you that most of them based on it were against it and they didn't really. And the tough part about analytics is how you relay it to your team. Okay. So if you early on back in the day, you know, people that I worked with wanted to be known as honest. So the honesty was, well, I'm just going to place everybody's analytics right on the wall on a sheet of paper and their name is going to be there next to their number. Well, that's okay if your analytics are in a positive direction. If your analytics that you post week after week or day after day are a negative, and I got to walk up to the wall and see that I'm not qualified according to the rest of my teammates to be in these situations, it becomes a problem. So how you display analytics, how you let people know where they're at is a real, what we call a feel. It's a feel once you get to feel your team. I went through the same process in Linz. There were different times when I would probably post or do things that I didn't feel in my experience in the game would really bother some people. But in fairness to now maturing in life and looking back, there were probably times when some of the, whether it be a North American or Austrian, really didn't care to see those numbers out on the walls because it's a, you know, it's not a comfortable situation. So I think the key in analytics is how you display it. I think how you get your message across, whether it's individual or as a team, but I think the power still remains the same. The power is off the charts in terms of producing numbers on any part of the game of hockey. It's just how you deliver that message and how often and which manner you do it.
Now, as you said, the biggest benefit of analytics, and I know there's so much more that goes into a team, the chemistry in the locker room, the group of guys, how they're getting along on and off the ice, how the coach behaves and treats players. So many intangibles that obviously can't be measured. But at the beginning of this conversation, you said that analytics help you to get to the root of problems. But what's, if we flip it around, probably the biggest danger when dealing with analytics? Is it just what you alluded to, that you need to be careful how you deliver the message?
I would say that's still number one. For sure, Martin, that's still number one, how you deliver the message. And two, I think you have to have a pretty good sense of the people that you work with above you. You call it managing up, your general managers and people that are above you, your team presidents, your owners. And I think the people that are somewhat, if you want to say, below you and the players and other people. I think when you choose and what you to display, not so much display, but actually track is really critical. There are some teams right now and some people that believe that, you know, analytically, I might have just four or five areas I want to track as a coach. And then there are other teams or players or coaches, general managers that want to track almost everything as much as they can. And they want to cross-examine and sit down at night and look at a three-ring binder full of analytics. And, you know, because like, let's say with the Vancouver Canucks, we have an analytics team that I think the company that works for the Vancouver Canucks, last I heard, which was probably a good year ago, so I can't qualify it, because now we're under new management and new direction since this last Christmas. But I know the analytics company a couple of years ago, within the last year and a half, was employed 900 people that tracked analytics. 900. So, you know, you're basically getting a Spiro notebook of every game and pie-shaped, whatever form you want it in. You're getting a handout upon handouts upon handouts and giving you so much information. It's almost overwhelming. So I think how you dissect or how you cut that up and which part of those you deliver, I think you have to have, again, a tremendous feel for the people you work around and then produce it that way. And then still have the right feel of when you put it out and how you put it out.
But let's try to break it down to the nitty gritty. You're getting this couple dozen pages binder, maybe even more, where up to 900 people have worked on. What kind of information are you looking for? If you had to sieve through such a huge binder, what telltaling signs that might help you along the way are you looking for personally?
For me personally, it's just it's really about scoring chances. That's how I see the game. I think it's what your players can produce versus what they give up. I think it's unfair to ask any athlete at any age, whether you're playing hockey in Europe or in the US or Canada, to score goals. I think that's unfair. I don't feel that that's fair for a coach or a parent to ask your son or daughter to score goals. I think what you should be asking is for them to produce more scoring chances per game than they give up. And I think that helps not only them, but I think it helps their team the best. And that's the way to contribute to a team. So, you know, back in the day, for example, a Jaromir Jagr in certain games would turn out, he'd be a 10-0. He would get 10 scoring chances in a game and maybe 3 or 4 points in a game and give up 0 scoring chances against. Now that's off the charts. For an example, in Linz, a Brian Lebler, a Corey Locke, a Dan De Silva, amongst others, no disrespect to the guys I didn't name, but those guys could turn in games where they were 9-1, 8-1, 8-0, 7-0, you know, because Brian has the ability physically and athletically to turn in a lot of numbers, right? So that 1 year between him and Locke, they would turn in big numbers. And they would come in and I would just say, hey, and they would ask, how were my numbers? And I would say, like I tell you, it doesn't matter how many goals and assists, but you were a 10-1. Like, I couldn't ask for any more out of you today than what I got last night. I'm really proud of you. Like, that's all you can ask. And so that to me is the most important one. And then when you go against an opponent, like we're talking about in a few minutes here, is Stanley Cup Finals. You're going to look head-to-head after game one. Which line head-to-head produced the most scoring chances, and what tweaks do you have to make? Do you have to move one player off one line to make that player better for the scoring chances to go either down or up? Let's say you're not getting enough scoring chances out of a couple guys. Well, you want to move another guy onto that line because you think he'll help produce more scoring chances for and give your best players a chance to score, and you're not losing anything defensively. He's the same as the other guy, but this guy's playing a little bit better right now. So you kind of juggle some people around based on the scoring chances head to head, if that makes sense.
Now, one interesting thing is that you've always worked in North American leagues where I'd say that the numbers and the availability of stats is way better than it's in Europe, and it's been growing, it's been coming, but this league at this point doesn't even have time on ice for all the teams. How important for analytics is the quote-unquote source material that you're working with?
It's really critical. I'm a little bit probably different, Martin, than a lot of people. I believe that I choose analytics when I'm a head coach based on what I can do and figure out myself. So it wouldn't matter where I worked, you know, if I can watch the film and break down the film and do the analytics myself for the most part, I'm a big fan of that. So how would that help the audience? Like if I was an NHL coach today, whether I was a head or an assistant, I would want somebody on my staff or multiple people on my staff to watch the game themselves versus hiring a video coach. I think the power of analytics is when you put the whole puzzle together, where you actually watch the plays and how chances or any analytics you're tracking have been produced and why they have been successful or they have not been successful. There's usually some linkage. So, right, you could track a shot on net. That's an analytic. Like, that's how many shots on net a player gets. But what was it he was doing to produce those shots? And that part of that linkage of tying him in, I think, is fair to the athlete. Basically, versus just saying, hey, you didn't get any shots on net last night. And if I would have said that back in the day to any player, they would have said, well, Wardle, like, I did all the other things you asked me to do. And I'm like, well, yeah, but you took six shots. You got two blocked and you missed the net four times. Okay, so there's that analytical side. I think you really have to, but you have to have a really good feel for your players and your team that are critical to give them the right information at the right time. You know, that's just such a critical component.
Before we get to the Stanley Cup Finals, and this one's a beauty of a matchup, just straight from the hip, and I know you're a straight shooter, the most overrated analytical stat in your estimation and the most underrated one. We're talking about expected goals. We're talking about wins above replacement or goals saved above average. All these Corsi and Fenwick and whatnot, all these stats and inventions that have come up the past 1.5, two decades. What's a stat or what's something that you like to use and go back to? What's something where you say that's overrated?
Overrated for sure would be plus minus, a player's plus minus. That's where you get into, you know, whether they're scoring chances versus if they're on the ice. You know, in fairness to a player, if he steps on the ice and they score a goal, but he's just getting on the ice and the goal's already happening in the offensive zone and he gets a plus for it, I think that's a very unfair stat. So I'm not a plus minus guy at all. I think that's a very unfair stat. I think for me, the other stat, I don't know how I would say this, how it relates to the Corsi and all that. Like, I'm not as deep into that as the other coaches that are in the game right now. But I would say that the stat that basically is not tracked enough is what they do and what they produce inside the house. Because it's a game of skill. Okay. It's the fastest game in the world. But it's a game of who can get closest to the net and still be successful at making plays. In the end of the day, that's really what it comes down to. And that's what will happen in the Stanley Cup. It's going to be who plays inside. Oftentimes back in the day, if we go back in time for our listeners, you and I, when we first started covering hockey years ago, and that coaches would always talk about the six pits, Martin. That's the four corners and the two front of the nets. You have to win the six pits to win the game. Well, now it's matured to basically, yes, you still have to be really a strong player or a team in the corners, but it's really come down to the net front in both ends of the ice. If you win those areas and you're better, either you have more numbers in front of your goalie and you have more numbers in front of their goalie, you're oftentimes a better team. Okay. So I think that stat of what you produce inside the dots, or as they would term it here, let's say in North America on TV podcasts or TV games, they'll say inside the house, inside the scoring area. That area there is not tracked enough and it's not defined enough. Okay. It's not defined enough as to how we're tracking that yet. And I think it's lending itself that way. So this year, the Jack Adams coach of the year was Daryl Sutter in Calgary. Okay. Basically, he's a puck possession maniac, and he's a puck possession guy in the offensive zone with shot volume mentality, meaning we are going to shoot, shoot, shoot. And the turnaround with the Calgary Flames was just based on one real stat for me, and that was play inside the dots. And they produced a lot of shots, and they got inside on teams all the time, by skate or by pass. And he tracks it that way. And that's what he did when he was in LA and when they won Stanley Cups. And so I think that's a stat that still is developing in the game.
Great stuff from you. as expected before we finally start talking about the Stanley Cup matchup that, or finals matchup that's hopefully providing us with 7 games. I want to back it up one last time talking about the Stanley Cup playoffs themselves. How did you follow them and what are your analytical takeaways from the 3 rounds of playoff hockey that we've seen so far?
Well, I followed them by, you know, just by way of watching. I do tape the games because I have a computer system. I have the ability to break games down myself as a coach still in a lot of ways. So I watched a lot of games live. I watch a lot of games the next morning when I get up where I can slow it down and look at the different ways that they're producing. I thought the Stanley Cup playoffs to this day have sorted themselves out just like I thought they would. I think the teams that had the goaltending issues going either acquired or happened in the playoffs, let's say Nashville, first round, they didn't have Soros, however you pronounce it, was their MVP all year, didn't play in the playoffs, and Colorado beat them 4 straight. Major problem. Okay, so kind of an easy series to a certain extent for Colorado. I thought the playoffs kind of just sorted themselves out the way I thought they would. I thought in the end of the day, Edmonton didn't have the goaltending. I thought that improved itself, even though I thought Smith was tremendous in a lot of series. Was not surprised by Washington's exit. Had just an average year. If there was one surprise so far in the playoffs, it was the ease that Tampa Bay had with Florida. Okay. The first round, Tampa Bay versus Toronto, gave you everything you wanted. Game 7, Game 6 was going in overtime. You know, Toronto scores a goal, it's over for Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay scores a goal, wins Game 7, 2-1. So I thought they've all sorted themselves out the way I thought they would. I thought Toronto didn't have the goaltending it needed. And I thought the goaltending, if there's been a surprise goaltending-wise, which is usually the backbone of a lot of Stanley Cup playoffs, the surprise really has been the tandem in Colorado. Either one's 6-0 and one's 6-2. They've only lost 2 games. So the big question is who's going to play tomorrow night, right? And so I think it sorted itself out. I was not surprised by any of the thing. And when Tampa Bay went down 2-0, I actually felt like I was in Linz. You know, it was Ostuga versus Croatia, and I felt like the games really weren't that lopsided. Tampa had some really good pushes. They just didn't, you know, they were a little bit tired or a little bit slow, I thought, coming out of the other series. Not tired, they were slow. So they lost games 1 and 2. Their timing wasn't very good. But I felt they were the better team, and they won 4 straight. So it's kind of worked itself out. Going into the year, Stanley Cup over here, obviously Colorado was the pick to be a Stanley Cup champion, and they're playing for it. And everybody said they're going to have to knock off Tampa. And that's held true.
The one thing that you mentioned, the East Tampa had with Florida. We had that series a year ago, and everybody said, okay, Florida's now been building for Tampa. They had a year to draw all the right conclusions from that first round exit last year. Now they're meeting in the second round. If you're a Florida fan, and even if you're a hockey fan, what does Florida have to do to get Tampa Bay's number? Is that something that can't be explained by analytics? That's just probably in their heads, where they need to slay the dragon, just as the Capitals did a couple of years back with the Penguins.
A little bit, and I think it's also, you know, potentially, I'm not there. Obviously, I'm a distant watcher from it. I don't have a great feel for it, but I would say from my experience in the game, they don't have the inner workings within the team and the togetherness that Tampa has. I think that is a culture situation. I think the Florida one is still developing. Obviously, they went out and traded for Giroux. They brought in him. They brought in some players that they felt could help them with experience and kind of blend this team together. I think it's a work in progress. They need to stay the course, but you know, you look at the game today and say, okay, if we're knocking on the door, but we have to improve our chemistry or our togetherness, whatever it may be, or we need another year of maturity, because in the end of the day, the teams that win, they mature to a level, they all become 200-foot players. They all really understand team, and they put team ahead of them, you know, themselves. It's always we before me. And I think that's not where they're at. And interestingly enough, they just let go of their assistant coaches yesterday or 2 days ago. So you look at it from that perspective and you say, okay, well, you know, geez, you had a wonderful regular season. How bad did the coaches do? I'm a pro coach, right? Like I would say, like, come on, like, but obviously they felt something different. So they feel maybe the players are right. They're changing the coaches, but that's the way the game usually is, right? So it's an interesting thing shaping up in Florida. But they've got to figure that out.
Maybe it just takes this gut punch again and again. And just the other day, there was a great interview by John Tortorella on theathletic.com where he said and John Tortorella to this day is still the last coach to defeat the Tampa Bay Lightning in a playoff series back 3 years ago in a sweep at the hands of the Columbus Blue Jackets. And he said, quote unquote, in that series, we created a monster because Tampa Bay hasn't lost ever since. And they're looking for a third consecutive Stanley Cup in their head-to-head matchup against the Colorado Avalanche. They're looking for their third as an Avalanche franchise as well. When that matchup was set after Game 6 and Tampa's win in at home against the Rangers, what was the first thought that went through your head?
Well, they're right on the doorstep of as a dynasty. I mean, you're going to compare them to the Islanders, the Red Wings, the Penguins, the Oilers. They're right in that talk now. There are different times. There's been some dynasties and some runs. And for sure, they have all indications right now that they want to be that dynasty and give them full marks as from the coaching to the ownership to the general manager to all the players. I mean, especially the players, I think the resiliency they've shown is outstanding. So they're on the doorstep. That's the first thing that came to my mind is that we're on the doorstep of a dynasty.
Now, our great friends over at Unibet, they've been looking at the matchup as well. They've been crunching numbers all week long. And to them, and not only to them, but to a lot of experts as well, the Colorado Avalanche favorites for the Stanley Cup. It's a 1 to 1.52 the odds are 1 to 1.52 for them winning it right now. Obviously, the odds on Tampa Bay going for a third Stanley Cup in a row would be 1 to 2.65. How are you rating the chances of the team? Is Colorado the favorite for you as well? Or is it even up to even odds for you?
Well, it's as even odds as we've had in a long time. I mean, you look at since the pandemic, since certainly after I left Linz and what happened in our world. I mean, 2 years ago, they played Dallas and, you know, no one in the hockey world really wanted that matchup. We got it. It's the great Cinderella story. And then it even became more of a Cinderella story last year with the Montreal Canadiens. So I think for hockey fans and enthusiasts, like if you said, do we finally have a really even Stanley Cup where it could go either way and possibly a 7-game series, this is it. I mean, this is the two horses going at it. Like these are the big boys right now. And so it's a toss up, you know, right now for me a little bit. Obviously I have to make a pick on who I think would win and I'll say that, but I would say this is close to a toss up as we've had. And it's a toss up even analytically. The unknown factor is just maybe a couple of injured players and if they're playing. That's the big thing. What's everybody's wondering right now. Does Point go in? Does Kadri go back in? Does Caliago go back in? Like, and supposedly those players are. So it's going to play an impact in the series.
Obviously, we'll make people wait for your pick a little bit. It's coming at the back end of the show. We want to dissect the matchups a little bit, the teams a little bit. If someone, for whatever reason, hasn't followed the National Hockey League's regular season and the three rounds of playoff hockey behind us, if someone hasn't seen the Avalanche so far this year, what are the Avalanche's biggest strengths and their biggest weakness? And we're talking about a Stanley Cup final participant, so weaknesses, well, probably not too many, if any.
Right. Well, the strengths for Colorado for me is just basically they're firing on all cylinders. They've only lost two games. That's all they've lost. So they've lost two games the whole playoffs, and they're firing on all cylinders. Obviously, they're well-rested coming into game one. I think the other strength that they have for a lot of listeners that maybe wouldn't know back home where you are is Cale Makar. This guy is over here is being compared to Bobby Orr on a daily basis. They think he's better than Bobby Orr. You know, he's leading their team in scoring right now in the playoffs. He's got 22 points in 14 games, 5 goals. He's only got 1 power play goal. So that tells you how active and how powerful he is in the 5-on-5 game. But I think those are two factors. I think the other one, which is interesting, I also believe that through the Stanley Cup playoffs, I think their goaltending has been a strength. And the reason why I say that is because Tampa Bay is going to play Vasilevskiy, and then they have a former goalie of mine as a backup who will never hit the ice unless the other guy's injured, and Brian Elliott, who's a capable goaltender in the NHL but has not played at all this year. But the interesting part why I think Colorado has a strength is that if for some reason if Vasilevskiy doesn't play to his ability, you're not going to put in probably Brian Elliott, okay? The thing that's been going well for Colorado is obviously Francouz is 6-0, and Kemper, who's now healthy, is 6-2. So it'll be interesting to see who they play, but I consider their goaltending a strength in the playoffs. Their 5-on-5 goal scoring has been off the charts, and Makar are definitely Colorado's strengths.
Weaknesses, any?
Weaknesses really have been for me, which I think is going to play a part of this series, is because it has to do with maturity. They're less mature than the Tampa Bay, but they have not been good in the faceoff circle. They have not. And that means you're going to chase the game a little bit. So if you're not winning your faceoffs, you're going to end up chasing the game a little bit. And, you know, I think that's a big unknown stat going into this series. It'll be interesting to see. The good news for Colorado is, yes, we're not good on faceoffs, but we always, because of our skating ability, we get the puck back right away. But the fact is, you're playing the Stanley Cup champion. So it's not like you can just say, well, we're going to rely on getting the puck back all the time. You're playing the best of the best for going into 3 years. So I think that's a negative. And then I believe that people would say over here, like, you know, I don't know if their bottom four D play as well as Tampa Bay's bottom four D. And I think that's going to be under a little bit of pressure. Would you say that they're getting more points and contributing more? The answer is yes. But when you're in the Stanley Cup finals and you're in the pressure, I don't know if that bottom four has the same maturity as McDonough and some of the guys in Tampa Bay. I feel their maturity is off the charts. And I think their ability to be calm, or what we would call in, I think, Austria's Ruhig, German, right? I believe that they're going to definitely be more calm and in control of the series than the other one. So I consider that a negative for Colorado.
Still, what Colorado's got going for it, or for them, they're an offensive juggernaut unlike any we've seen in recent playoff memory, whereas Tampa's won the Eastern Conference Final, Game 7 last year, 1-0, and the Stanley Cup clinching game 2-1, just like a game against the Rangers a couple of days ago. So low scoring affairs, and we all look back and still kind of marvel at the series opening win of Colorado in round 3. I think it was an 8-6 against the Edmonton Oilers. As regards the goals scored, the bookies over at Unibet estimates that the chances for 6 goals or less are higher than 6 goals and more. And if we look at the odds for 6 goals or less in game 1, it's 1 to 1.77. So not really, really good odds if you're looking for value. Do you think we're going to see a high scoring series with all the offensive potential involved? Or is it just natural that during the Stanley Cup finals, everything reverts back to lower scoring?
Oh, great question, Martin. I would say that I think in this series and some of these games, we're going to have blowouts one way or another. And I think it's going to be regroup time mentally after. I think you're going to find some games. I think Colorado maybe had a few games in games 1 of the series where they won like 6-2, 7-2. Wouldn't shock me if you get that here in this series on either side. Because obviously we didn't really say it. I said that I thought Colorado has a strength actually in their goaltending, but it's also a weakness in terms of going against Vasilevskiy. Obviously they're not qualified to be in the same breath as Vasilevskiy and Kemper and Francouz. So It could be a weakness, but I think you're going to see some potentially lopsided games more so than we anticipate, in my opinion. They played each other twice this year. The math and the analytics would say I'm wrong, what I just said, because the games have been one goal games. One's been a shootout. One's been a three to, and the Avalanche won them both. So head to head this year, they're 2-0 against Tampa, and they've both been one goal games. So it tells you that I think it was 3-2 and 4-3. But I think we're going to see, based on the length of the Stanley Cup with the number of games Tampa has played, and then less games that Colorado has played, I think you're going to see some lopsided games at times.
But speaking of tight games, one of the things that good friends over at Unibet discovered is that the odds for the score of game one are highest with a 3-2 game in favor of Colorado. The odds are 1-13 if anyone out there dares betting it. You've already talked about the returning players. You talked about some intangibles. But is there an X factor that we haven't talked about yet that might tip the scale towards Colorado and their chances of winning the Stanley Cup?
Well, I think the X factor is, does Cogliano and Kadri play? I think if they do, then they can help answer the bell versus Maroon and Perry. I think that's an interesting part of this series is, you know, you take Maroon and Perry in Tampa Bay and you put their hard, truculent way of playing, kind of get under your skin type players. I feel that Colorado will really benefit if they have Kadri, who's potentially going to play now in game one, and Cogliano. I think if those two play versus Maroon and Perry, you got a really interesting series. So for me, that's the big kind of unknown, and that could swing the series is when do those two guys play and when do they put themselves in the lineup and what's the difference they make?
Obviously, their game readiness hasn't been put out yet, or we just have to assume that they might be playing. But when I got the odds from Unibet, Colorado already was the favorite to win game one at 1-2.04. Tampa Bay having an outside chance at 1-3 odds, but maybe they're able to steal one as they've done so often throughout their two cup runs of the past 2 years. If someone's been living behind the moon, hasn't followed hockey, hasn't seen Tampa Bay finally getting over their hump in the bubble, in the pandemic season, and then doubling down last year against the Montreal Canadiens, how would you describe the team that's on the brink of being a dynasty to someone who hasn't seen them play? What are their strengths and weaknesses?
Their biggest strength, Martin, is their experience. That's their biggest experience. That's the biggest strength they have going into this final series. They have experience. You remember all the great teams when the Islanders and Gretzky always talks about, you know, when they lost to the Islanders and he walked by the locker room after they lost and he looked in the room and the guys were just laying back exhausted. Like the Islanders guys were just exhausted. They weren't even moved. They weren't even out of their equipment. Gretzky and that group in Edmonton was already out of the building. And you get that once you get that experience, I think you know what it takes to win. And I think they just showed that in this Island or the Rangers series. I think they really showed their experience. I think they were calm. I think they didn't panic. So that is a huge factor in this series. That's their biggest positives. There are other positives similar to Colorado in that we didn't really say it, but I think both teams' best players have been their best players throughout the playoffs. Whether you put like Stamkos now between, you know, he's with Palat and Kucherov. They had a wonderful, they got better every game last series. So I think that's going well. Obviously the Landeskog, Ratnan, McKinnon, all those guys are just firing on all cylinders for Colorado. So I think they kind of wash each other out. Both teams' best players have been their best players. The unknown factor is your bottom 4D and your bottom 6 forwards. I think that's the key to the series. And I think Colorado needs to show that they're healthy. People have not liked the fact that some of the acquisitions Tampa made in their bottom 6 have not produced. But I think they've produced in ways that a coach a general manager, a team would want them to produce. I don't think statistically or analytically in the Twitter world and the Instagram world, they've produced to the level that everybody follows. I think within the team itself, they've done a tremendous job. So I think that's a big factor in the series. The other thing about just their positives is obviously their goaltender is a huge advantage in the series. And then the unknown factor, the X factor, not so much the X factor that you want to ask me about, but I think in terms of their positives is Cooper. Cooper, the coach. That's no disrespect to Jared Bednar. He's a wonderful coach. He's had a wonderful run. He's done an awesome job with this team. But right now, you look at Cooper and you look at his track record, he has won at every level he's coached at. So he's on the brink of something special. And ironically, he's never won the Jack Adams.
The interesting thing that you just mentioned, that John Cooper never won the Jack Adams trophy. If one looks at the National Football League, it's the same thing. Bill Belichick has won 6 Super Bowls as a head coach, but I think only one Coach of the Year award. And that's probably the thing. If you're consistently winning and not one of the quote-unquote surprise teams of the year, you obviously don't qualify for individual coaching accolades. But one of the interesting statements leading up to the playoffs and the Stanley Cup Finals that I read somewhere came from Craig Berube, I think, who said, once you get to the playoffs, once you get to the finals, it's not the top two lines that are deciding games. It's the guys on line 3, on line 4, the quote-unquote depth guys. How much truth would you attest to that statement?
100%. I couldn't agree with Craig anymore if that's the guy that said it. I really believe you're like we've just talked about a minute ago, Martin. Like, I think that the best players on both of these teams have been just tremendous in the playoffs, and they continue to score at record paces and they're carrying their teams. The unknown factor will be how do these, let's just, for lack of a better term, bottom 6 players as forwards, bottom 4D, how do they play in this series? And then most importantly, how do they handle it mentally? Because I think there's going to be some highs and lows in these games. And you got to have really a short-term memory. You got to bounce right back. And that's where, as I talked about a little bit ago, I find that the experience on the Tampa side is pretty high. I think they have the resiliency and they're calm under pressure and things like that. So I think Craig is right on with that comment.
Now, as with Colorado, you'd really have to go into or have to take a close look to find a weakness on any team. Obviously, if one thinks about Tampa Bay and their playoff runs of the not only 3 years, but many, many years that they've now been in the postseason. I think the last 5 years they played an additional 82 game regular season just in the playoffs when the stakes are highest. This is probably a factor that they might have just played too many of those games and that Colorado is just a fresher team, especially with the additional rest?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's going to be we'll find out right away what that factor is, whether that rest sometimes in coaching, the old coach would say rest equals rust, so how rusty are they in game one? Game one and series are very important in the Stanley Cup history playoffs. They're always a very important game. So, or that rest is going to be not at rust. Now, I would say through the 3 rounds, so far to this point, Colorado has proved that rest isn't rust. I think it's helped them, and they've been tremendous. So it doesn't seem to be a factor so far, but this has been an extended rest for them versus maybe Tampa. And Tampa might be wheeling a little bit through the first, 10 minutes of the game. You just got to survive that storm, and they have the ability to do that. So it'll be interesting.
Obviously, I'm going to make you pick the winner of the series. But before we do this, we, of course, know that Unibet has a special offer for all the new customers. It's a 400% welcome bonus. Just use the promo code HOCKEY-BONUS while putting 10 euros into your new account for the first time and receive 40 euros for free. That's right, for free. More details in the show notes of this podcast. And of course, as always, it's Unibet, by players, for players. And one last thing, Coach, before I'm forcing you to make a pick, and you said it's as much a toss-up as any we've seen in recent memory. you're busy during summertime. Normally, one would think a hockey coach has it a little easier when there's no hockey or not a lot of hockey is happening. But your hockey and Suns camps have been going strong for years now. If someone's from the Land of the Thousand Lakes area or close to Wisconsin, what is Hockey and Suns?
Hockey and Sons is a parent-child experience where the parent goes to hockey camp and goes on the ice every day with their child. So they share ice time together. They eat together. Obviously, they're sleeping in the same dorm room. They're going to dry land activities together. They get a lecture. Kevin Constantine is my lecture guy. So they get video, they get some teaching in a classroom setting. It's a bit of an old school hockey school. It's but you do it with your child and you sit right next to them in the locker room and you help them get dressed and you help them on and off the ice and you experience everything they go through. I think it's a unique situation for a parent to actually, because so many parents today had never played the game, but their kids are involved. And now they have a different appreciation versus sitting in the stands, never putting on their skates, what their son or daughter is going through on the ice. So that's the kind of the format. We spend basically 3 full days and 2 half days. So 4 days together at in a camp setting at a university here in Minnesota. And it's a great time. Great bonding experience, I think, Martin, is the best way to say it.
And these camps have been huge successes. Two out of three are already sold out. There are still some openings for the June 25th to 29th camp happening right at the tail end of the Stanley Cup finals. And there might be some news in store as regards Hockey and Suns. I don't know if you're already able to talk about it. If not, you're going to be back on the program and we'll be able to get the news out then.
Yeah, we're... we've been very fortunate. This is our 25th year. It's something I never envisioned to that I would still be doing Hockey and Suns 25 years later. We've been able to sell out every year. As you mentioned, we have a few openings left in the first camp. We had a whole bunch of people cancel because of the COVID issue, because we have usually 4 countries represented every summer at Hockey and Suns. This year, because of the travel restrictions still for a lot of people, uncomfortable. People did sign up and then canceled in this first camp. So we're a little light there, but not much. But and now we're talking about Hockey and Suns in Europe. So it looks like a year from now on our website, which is just www.hockeyandsuns.com. We should be launching sometime in the next month here, a European version of Hockey and Suns, where we would end up probably, my guess is early on, Martin, to be that we're working on would be in Innsbruck. So we will have U.S. families or Canadian families traveling and then hopefully be able to attract some European people as well from different countries.
Sounds like a great experience. If it's happening, we're of course putting the message out here on Unibet Hockey O'Clock as well. And the URL you just mentioned is of course in the show notes of this podcast. It's www.hockeyandsuns.com. Great project that keeps you busy, obviously, throughout the off season. What's I'm sure been keeping you up at night is the one pick that you have to make, and it's gonna come. But the one other pick you have to make that I didn't tell you or inform you about is about the Conn Smythe Trophy, the playoff MVP. The odds are now, as of this recording or at the time of this recording, best or in favor of Cale Makar. They're sitting at 1 to 2.95. Then it's Nathan MacKinnon at 1 to 3.2, and then Andrei Vasilevskiy at 1 to 5.25. I'm not going to make you pick anyone, but obviously those three favorites are fairly obvious for the Conn Smythe, depending on who's winning it. Who out of those three players that I didn't mention on either team would be your next front runner? So we got Makar, MacKinnon, and Vasilevskiy. Who'd come to mind first if those three or one of those three doesn't win a Conn Smythe?
For sure, Stamkos for me. 2 years ago, one shift in the bubble, one goal. That's all he played in the Stanley Cup. That was it. And right now, the way he's playing, I think he's been underestimated throughout the playoffs. If I was to pick a guy based on the history of the game, when you look at Bork in Colorado, guys that won and, you know, guys that went through the process and just had great endings to towards the end of their career, I would take Stamkos as a Conn Smythe.
Would be great if one of the game's greatest also gets a coveted trophy. But the most coveted trophy in all of hockey and probably all of team sports, of course, still is the Stanley Cup. Which team is hoisting the Stanley Cup after how many games?
I would take Tampa Bay in six.
There you go. Winning it on home ice and a three-peat. So you already alluded to it at the beginning of the conversation a little bit. They then officially qualify as a dynasty, right?
Correct. They would be for sure a dynasty and showing very... I mean, you know, they're obviously aged. I mean, Colorado's like 27.5 in their forward age and Tampa Bay right now is at 30. So they're typical of all the dynasties are getting to that road where they're going to have to make some significant changes, but I still think they're intact. And that's the reason why with their experience, I would take them in six.
Great stuff, coach. So educational to hear from you. So many things that I learned, so many things that hopefully get listeners ready for a great Stanley Cup final. So thankful that you jumped onto the program and looking forward to talking to you about analytics and everything that goes into hockey at some point soon.
Sounds good. I appreciate your time, Martin, and hello to everybody back overseas, and I hope that everybody is well.
Exzellente Unterhaltung mit dem schönsten Sport der Welt. Unibet Hockey.